I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The Pennsylvania Society had its annual meeting in New York City this past weekend. 3 days of schmoozing and fundraising among a party elite, the wannabes, and their supporters. There were some no-shows, including Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf still trying to craft a budget with the Republicans in Harrisburg. Our guest, WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies, was in New York on Friday and Saturday and joins us on Radio Times to tell us what he saw, who he talked to, and what this is all about. And Dave, nice to have you with us back on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us as well. Just make sure his microphone is turned on. And this is always the question asked. Why does the Pennsylvania Society meet in New York City?
That I can tell you in a word, tradition.
117 years, apparently.
Yeah, the line from Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah, it goes back to when Pennsylvania politicians were, if not controlled, heavily influenced by big industrialists in New York, coal and railroad and steel barons. And they would pay to bring Pennsylvania legislators up to New York for a weekend of schmoozing and drinking and things they probably wouldn't want to tell their spouses, and then get their marching orders. And it just sort of grew and grew. And so now it's more than 30 events over 4 days. I mean, and so that every elected officials and candidates and political operatives and lobbyists and people that want to be around those people, including reporters, all descend them on that area for all these events. And it's a lot of networking.
It seems like an odd time to – I mean, this is an annual event, but nonetheless, we're talking about Pennsylvania without a budget. Did that cast a pall at all on any of the festivities?
Well, it certainly made for a lot of no-shows. I mean, I remember one of the events that I always go to is the law firm Blank Rome holds a big reception, and I go there. I hang outside because that's where all the Philadelphia folks go, and there was a lot of standing vacant room there. Yeah, the legislators didn't feel that they could be there, nor the governors, because just the optics of being in plush ballrooms and, at cocktail parties while people in need are not seeing a budget resolved. So, yeah, it definitely depressed attendance. But the events themselves felt about the same.
I thought it was interesting. Joe Sestak, who is running for the Senate, was apparently in Harrisburg or certainly didn't attend but had spent some time, I think, in Harrisburg on Friday helping, homeless people, handing out blankets and food, things like that.
Yeah, nice touch, isn't it? I mean, and Joe Sestak is a guy who is not beloved among Democratic Party leaders because, back 6 years ago, he defied their wishes and ran against Arlen Specter, who you'll recall had switched parties and was their choice for Senate. They were very angry at Sestak for doing that and haven't forgiven them. He's an outsider. He plays his own game, does his own thing. And I do think just politically that was just a very smart way to handle it at the moment.
Well, you had an interesting piece about a guy named John Fetterman. People in Pennsylvania might not know that he is running for the U.S. Senate. He's the mayor of a place, Braddock, Pennsylvania. My understanding is it's a tiny little town. And he was there in New York City. What was he doing, Dave?
Yeah, it's a tiny, impoverished coal town and largely African-American and poor. He is a white guy who kind of came up and had a social service background. I believe he was in AmeriCorps. He went to the Kennedy School and was interested in policy that helps cities. And he was barely elected mayor of Braddock and has been there for several terms. And his campaign is about, unequal distribution of income and all that. He's our own Jesse Ventura. He is 6'8" or 6'9".
Really?
375 pounds.
Wow.
Bald guy, big beard, and tattoos all over his arms. Tattoos, the zip code of Braddock is one tattoo. And then there's a tattoo for each person killed in a homicide in Braddock while he was there. This sort of visual display of his commitment. It's funny. He speaks in a wonky sort of way. He doesn't sound like a Jesse Ventura. He sounds like a guy who's been to the Kennedy School of Government and is interested in policy. But he says he's serious about running for the United States Senate. He would face two other candidates, and if he wins, run against Republican Pat Toomey. And he says, I reached the limits of what I could do in my office. I need to think bigger.
And did he seem sort of oddly out of place?
Oh, you bet.
At the Waldorf Astoria or some of these other New York City hotels?
Absolutely. I spoke to him in the lobby of the Waldorf, and he said, yeah, the people here are lovely. I feel like a fish out of water here. It's interesting. When I first spoke to him in September, I said, can you run statewide without putting on a suit? Are you going to change your act? He said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be who I'm not. So he was there in his work shirt, but he unbuttoned it, and underneath there was a tuxedo T-shirt, a T-shirt with a printed tuxedo
nice
pattern.
Touch.
He said he was just glad he hadn't been stopped by hotel security yet.
You also wrote that he was being videotaped by a group calling themselves America Rising, and then you went to find out who this group is. Who are they, and what are they doing?
Yeah, well, there was a young man who was a tracker, which is sort of a position that's arisen in campaigns the last 20 years, where you pay some usually young person to get a video camera and videotape the candidate that you're tracking's every public utterance. You just follow them everywhere, hoping that they will say something stupid or get involved and lose their temper or just look awful. John Fetterman said, "Yeah, I got this guy over here. His name's John. He's a nice kid." So I went over and spoke to him, and he said he couldn't talk to me, but gave me the email of his boss. And they did indeed confirm they are tracking John Fetterman and the other two Democratic candidates, Joe Sestak and Katie McGinty, because they want to hold Democrats accountable. Right. They're a group that's been around since 2013, formed by some conservative operatives. They do a lot of stuff, negative material on Hillary Clinton. And so we'll see whether they come up with anything they can use.
Was Katie McGinty there?
She was there, making the rounds, shaking hands. One of the things you want to do if you're a politician there is buttonhole people who can be contributors or supporters and people who may not have returned your phone calls. You go to the big law firm reception of the lobbyist, and some of these are really swank affairs. Oh. And you hope to get 2 or 3 minutes and make a personal appeal. Relationships matter, and they hope to build them.
This is a bipartisan affair, so it's both Republicans and Democrats who are there, right?
Sure, sure. And independents and aspirants and everybody else, yeah.
And Donald Trump was there. As I understood, he snuck in a door. There were probably protesters waiting for him somewhere, but he spoke to what, the Republicans?
Yeah. Well, remember that Pennsylvania Society Weekend is like 30 events. They're sprawling all over the place. They're kind of centered around the Waldorf Astoria. This was the Republican Party's annual Commonwealth Club fundraiser, which occurs on Friday at noon every year. And they always have a headline speaker. This year they chose Donald Trump. Huh? It was controversial 2 weeks ago when it was announced, but after he made his comments about banning Muslims from immigrating, it was really controversial. And yeah, it was a zoo. I mean, it's, the Plaza Hotel is this plush-paced place right on Central Park. There were probably a couple of hundred protesters. It was completely closed to the media. And I mean, we couldn't get on the same floor. I was expelled from the lobby twice. I mean, they just didn't want anybody near. But I have to say the protesters were quite clever. One had booked a room at the hotel so she could be there, and she had 6 people. They barged into the event, were quickly escorted out, shoved out in some cases. But they weren't the only ones. About 6 or 7 had bought tickets, $1,000 apiece, and one at a time rose to say something or read a poem or sing a song. They were all promptly ejected. So I'm told Trump handled it as he does. I mean, kind of dismissed them and made jokes.
Is it too early to say how the Republicans in Pennsylvania feel about Donald Trump?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans are very nervous about having him at the top of the ticket. I spoke to Pat Toomey, the U.S. Senator, and he tweeted last week that Trump's remarks about Muslim were completely wrong, that we don't have religious tests for immigration in this country. Charlie Dent, who is a Republican congressman, said this is the wrong guy for our party. There are some supporters, but I think there's no doubt that Republicans who will be running in this election, which will bring out more Democrats than in a non-presidential year, don't want to be in a position where every 2 weeks they are asked by reporters what they think about some outrageous statement that the guy who is at the top of their ticket has made. And the fear is that he will so turn off moderate Republicans and independents that they will not show up or show up and vote against Republicans. And so I think there's a lot of Republicans who want anybody but Trump, which is why Ed Rendell was telling people Trump is his candidate. I mean, this is a Democrat who thinks Trump would be the best thing for the Democrats since Goldwater. So he was all for that.
And I do want to pick up on that. Just a note there, Tom Ridge has been an outspoken critic of Donald Trump, I notice, and, pretty outspoken and willing to say some harsh things about
candidate. I didn't talk to him, but I know he was there and, was happy to denounce Trump at the drop of a hat.
Now, Ed Rendell was what, honored at the society meeting?
Yeah, the sort of central event of this thing is a huge formal dinner Saturday night run by the Pennsylvania Society itself. You can watch it on the Pennsylvania cable network if you want, and I promise that if you do, you will be convinced you'll never want to attend that dinner. It is endless. And
like hours and hours?
Well, a couple of hours, and there are 30 people on stage, and they have grand titles and are introduced, and it's quite tedious. But someone gets the gold medal. medal every year for service or some notable contribution to the Commonwealth. And this year it was Governor Rendell who stood. And by the way, he has a staph infection on his foot, so he was in sneakers beneath that tux. But he stood and appealed to business leaders to support pre-kindergarten funding in Philadelphia.
He's telling them what? Open your wallets. We've got to pitch in to make this happen?
The least we can do, yeah. Whether it fell on deaf ears, I don't know. But it's an appeal he made.
He did, as I understand, Dave, think that a Trump Cruise ticket would be very good for the Democratic
Party. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think he thinks it would be the best thing since Goldwater for the Democrats, and so he's all for it.
Typical Ed Rendell.
Yeah, yeah. Never shy to offer an opinion.
Now, was Shaka Fatah there? He's a congressman from the area. Was he at the Pennsylvania Society?
Indeed he was. Had a long conversation with him. He is a happy warrior. He is running while under federal indictment. He has four announced opponents and then a trial facing him just days after the April 26th primary of next year. And to listen to him, couldn't be happier, couldn't be more confident. He says he expects to win renomination and win every neighborhood and then prove himself innocent at trial. We'll see.
We will see. Any way to know whether people were staying away from him? Were they in any way put off by the allegations?
Not that I observed. I mean, these are events where friends and foes shake hands and pat each other on the back and say nice things about one another. I mean, Pat Toomey and John Fetterman were photographed next to one another. I mean, Fetterman towering over Toomey. So
terrific.
These things happen. The interesting thing, we'll know January 15th whether people are staying away at Shaka Fatah when he files his campaign finance report for the last quarter of this year, in which we will see whether he's been able to collect campaign checks or whether folks are not that interested in investing someone in his circumstance.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, was Jim Kenney there, the new mayor-elect, the mayor-elect of Philadelphia?
He was not. And it's interesting because I've been going for many years because it's helpful to me to talk to sources and pick up ideas. And I've usually seen Kenney there. I spoke to him last week and he said, no, I've kind of had it with that. I think I have better things to do. There was a kind of a mayoral training camp, a kind of a set of seminars for incoming mayors that a Harvard School of Government was sponsoring Thursday and Friday of last week. And then he wanted to be back for the Army-Navy game. I didn't see him and I didn't see any of his folks. I'm not sure that's so smart. I think it's really helpful for an elected official such as himself to get to know people there and let people see him. Now, he, of course, knows a lot of those folks. He's been going for many, many years, but now he's the mayor-elect of the city. It's maybe a little less important because the legislative leaders weren't there, and these are folks that the city of Philadelphia is going to have an agenda with every year. But he just decided it wasn't worth it. He's going to cut his own course.
And he's going to have a block party after his inauguration.
That's what he's saying, and I'm not surprised. He wants to be a guy who connects with people from every neighborhood and wants to make things better in every zip code. It'll be a tall order, but a symbolic effort of connecting with people as he is inaugurated, not just making it black tie, makes sense.
Dave Davies, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
WHYY senior reporter. You can check out his off-mic blog at Newsworks. We'll be talking about what's been happening in Paris after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. This past Saturday, the climate negotiators representing nearly 200 countries were all smiles, hugs, tears, high fives, and cheers. They had reached a joint agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the first global pact to address the threat of climate change. But with all complicated negotiations, though, it's important to read the fine print. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Robert Brule is a professor of sociology and environmental science at Drexel University, written extensively on environmental science. He also served as the co-director of the American Sociological Association's Task Force on Climate Change and Sociology, co-editor of the Task Force Report to Climate Change and Society. And Robert Brule, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times and is still in Paris. And Coral Davenport, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, great to be with you.
Let me start with you, Carol. I guess let's start with the good news, the fact that some 200 nations could come together and come to some kind of consensus or agreement on climate change. Is that the big takeaway from the weekend's agreement?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a landmark agreement. This is the first universal agreement on climate change in history. It's legally binding. It commits 195 countries and the European Union to a set of actions requiring them to lower their greenhouse gas emissions. There are a lot of ifs and ands and, you know, future things to look at. And as you mentioned, fine print to unpack. But the basic fact of this is something that, you know, advocates of climate change policy have been trying and pushing for decades and failing. And this is the first time this has ever happened. So that's a really, really big moment.
Robert, what's your response to what they were able to negotiate in Paris?
I guess for me, the question here is what the jury for me is still out. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with people. I think it's somewhere between the hype of the politicians saying that this is a landmark agreement, that climate change is now solved. And on the other hand, there was a whole series of climate scientists that talked about the agreement. James Hansen called it a fraud. Kevin Anderson called it worse than Copenhagen. So there's sort of these polar opposites, one saying, oh, this is it, it's solved. And on the other hand, you have climate scientists saying it's totally inadequate. And I think somewhere in the middle is more reasonable, is that for me, it's opens up the possibility of future actions. It doesn't, it at least comes to some sort of conclusion that we need to address this. And so in that sense, it's a positive move, but it devolves down then to what do 190 different countries do, and will they actually meet their intended contributions to the climate change mitigation goals?
Well, let me pick up on that. And Coral, I'm back at you. You mentioned the fact that it's legally binding. How so? How much are these countries really required to make some of the steps that are part of this agreement?
Well, just first, one response to what Robert is saying. Absolutely no one says that this deal solves climate change. None of the parties who have signed it. You know, if all of the elements that have been agreed to are enacted in this deal, the analysis show that it will reduce the levels of greenhouse gases about half as much as is necessary to stave off sort of the turning or tipping point of climate change. So just to be clear, no one is saying this solves climate change. At best, it gets you halfway there. It's a major first step, just to clarify that. In terms of what is legally binding and what is not, that was very artfully and carefully worked out. Here's what this deal does not do. It does not set a legally binding target for countries to cut their emissions. That is what the Kyoto Protocol of 1997 did. That deal ended up being a failure because in order to reach that target, I mean, that deal said, you know, every country is obliged to cut their emissions by a certain amount. This is a legal requirement. Go forth and do so. That was a treaty that required ratification by the Senate in the United States. The Senate refused to ratify that treaty. The U.S. ended up pulling out of the deal, effectively making it a failure. So going into Paris, negotiators led by the United States were acutely aware that any kind of deal that set forth legally binding targets for countries to act would absolutely not be ratified by the Senate. So here's the kind of delicate legal hybrid that they came up with. The deal says every country is required to come up with their own set of pledges or plans or domestic policies to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Those plans are designed by the country. They can be sort of whatever works at home for you. So almost every country has done this and is now bound to do this. The spectrum of the effectiveness of those pledges is very wide. The United States has pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions up to 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. That's a really significant cut. A lot of other pledges are not so strong. Russia's pledge would actually lead to a 40% increase in greenhouse gases. India's pledge would lead to a tripling of greenhouse gases by 2030. India and other experts point out that's actually a lower rate of increase.
Wow.
Than greenhouse gases would normally see. So it's a real wide range. Countries can come up with their own plan for what they're going to do. However, they're legally bound. Here's what they're required to come back to the table every 5 years for the life of this accord in perpetuity to put forth a stronger plan to continue whatever they've put forth now. They have to make stronger in 5 years, stronger again in 5 years, stronger again. They're legally bound to do that. And they're also legally bound to make all of their plans public. To be open for verification, to be open for outside monitoring. And so that's the mix, this idea that sort of this outside verification and this moving forward and ratcheting up the strength of what you already have will be legally binding. And so there's a question, as Robert said, a lot of this is very dependent on the future heads of states who are going to actually enact this plan.
Well, let me give you a chance to respond to that, Robert Brule. I mean, by using the sort of bully pulpit or the kind of openness of having to come back every 5 years, do you think that will force some kind of compliance?
Well, we'll see. It's going to devolve down to the politics of 190 different countries. I mean, I think one thing that, just to follow up on something that Coral said, is that what's new in this agreement is that in the old agreement, which was the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which started this whole process, there were two sets of countries. There were the Annex I countries, or the developed countries, and then there was the Annex II, or developing countries. And under Kyoto and under all the previous agreements, the onus of mitigation or reducing carbon emissions fell upon the Annex I or developed countries, and the developing countries were allowed to do, you know, they didn't have any restraints on their development. Well, that doesn't work anymore. That's gone. All the countries, as Coral said, have to have their contributions. They have to put in a contribution, which they all did. They vary widely, but they all have something in, and they're going to review them. Now, my understanding is that the first review of this is going to be in 2023, that this treaty goes into effect in 2020, that we'll review these goals in 2023, and then every 5 years thereafter. So that is a step in the right direction. The question is, of course, what will the politics be in Russia? What will the politics be in China? What will the politics be, or the economics in the United States? That's going to vary, and it's an open and contingent process. So for me, this sort of, it allows the UN process to go forward and to remain relevant and legitimate as the arena on a global stage where we do these, where these efforts come into review, and citizens and NGOs and can hold their governments accountable to see whether they're actually fulfilling them. So for me, I think that is probably one of the positive steps. The other question, though, is, you know, if you have a change in the political situation, and let's say the Republican Party captures the White House, one wonders what will happen to, you know, the ability of the United States to meet its own goals. I mean, so it's a contingent question. And I guess what was interesting for me is that I actually, when I flew back yesterday, I was on a flight with Bill McKibben.
Oh, interesting. We had a piece in the New York Times today.
And so we had 7 hours to sit there and talk about life, the universe, and everything. But it was quite interesting for me, and you know, as we talked through this thing, was that it opens up the possibility for citizens and NGOs to hold their governments accountable to the pledges they've made. So they've said, oh, yeah, we're going to do this. Well, okay, now we're going to hold them accountable. And in that sense, I think a lot of it is going to be a factor of how strong are the climate change movements across the globe. Will they be able to have a national impact to force their governments into acting? And Bill McKibben has an excellent editorial in today's New York Times, along with a really great article by Coral explaining the whole process. So, I mean, the New York Times is sort of must reading this morning. And no, I'm not paid by ExxonMobil for it.
No, fair enough. Let me just jump in here only because I want to just quickly reintroduce the two of you and also let our listeners join the conversation. That's Robert Brule, professor of sociology, environmental science at Drexel University. As he just mentioned, flew back yesterday from Paris, where there was an accord on climate change and what countries can or should do to address the problem of climate change. Also with us is Coral Davenport, covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times, and she is still in Paris. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What were you hoping for from this agreement in Paris? Coral, let me go to you. And we're not talking about a treaty here. So is this an agreement that just allows the current president, President Obama, to go ahead and put some of these policies into effect? Does it have to go before Congress to get approval? Where does this stand, I guess, politically in this country?
Right. So, you know, as I mentioned before, in the year leading up to this, there has been so much work done to ensure that this that the legal form of this agreement is not a treaty that has to go before the United States Senate, and yet that it is still legal, that the provisions of it are still legally binding. So in the United States, this is now a legally binding agreement that the United States has signed on to as a party. The United States is legally bound to follow through on all the provisions of this agreement right now, and it doesn't have to go before Congress. Well, how can that be?
Yes.
Here's how. If there had been a provision saying all countries must cut their emissions by a certain amount, say every country has to cut their emissions by 5%, that agreement would have triggered the legal conditions for a treaty, and it would have had to go before the Senate. Something else that would have done that is all, you know, rich countries shall contribute a certain amount of money to help poor countries adapt to climate change. That absolutely would have been a treaty had to go before the Senate. So those two provisions are not in there. Again, what's in there is the form that every country comes up with what they can do according to how they can do it. So it's a softer and more voluntary set of pledges. What's legally binding is the process. So the substance isn't legally binding. The process is. The U.S. has now agreed, is legally bound. The U.S. has to go back and follow this process. Go back in 5 years. The first meeting is actually in 2020. Present a stronger plan than has already been put forth. So that's going to be on the desk of the next president. It'd be very interesting to see how President Trump or President Rubio will do that.
Yep.
Also legally binding is the transparency regime. All countries will be required to monitor, report, and verify their emissions reductions on the same universal system. Everyone has to use the same metrics. Their emissions all have to be publicly disclosed. Going forward, the plan is to create an outside body of international experts. I call it sort of a carbon auditor, who would externally verify that countries are doing what they say they're going to do. So that's how they kind of strike this balance of having something that doesn't have the substance itself is not legally binding. You can, as a country, choose whatever how you're going to do this. But the process is you have to do it in a very public way. Everyone has to follow the same timetable. Everyone is subject to outside verification. And if a country does not do those things, then a country is flouting international law. And that is really significant.
Do you think, Robert Brule, the kind of shaming and naming that it sounds like it's part of this agreement, that will put pressure on countries to make some steps and be more compliant?
Well, I mean, this whole process comes out of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which passed in 1992. So in one way, they're extending the legal authority of an already existing climate treaty. So this isn't the first climate treaty overall. I mean, the 1992 treaty is providing the legal basis for this protocol. And so they're arguing that this is just an extension of that treaty. So legally, they don't have to go back to the Senate. Now, whether I think it's going to be country by country is that if a country doesn't, I can't imagine that Saudi Arabian politicians are going to have a whole lot of, you know, internal dissent over there if they don't meet their goals. It can vary widely. So I think it, once again, it devolves down. So in the United States, if we have a strong social movement, if the media report well on what's going on and the failure of or the success of what the administration in power at that time does, that can have a big effect on whether we're going to hold whether citizens can hold their government accountable. And for me, that's the real key here, is that this is really provides a mechanism for citizens in all of these different countries to hold their governments accountable and to name and shame their politicians, and that you voted against it, well, we're going to vote you out, or you know, you voted against it, we're going to continue to vote you in. I mean, it's going to depend, but I think that that's that for me is it allows a continuing role for civil society and social movements in the process, and that good critical media reporting is going to be a real factor here too.
And Robert, we're almost up on a break here, but it seems at least in some quarters, citizens are organized. Certainly, scientists are pretty much on the same page. Do you see a vibrant citizen organization or series of organizations in this country?
Well, I mean the climate change movement in the United States has grown dramatically over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, I count the number of civil society organizations that show up every year at these meetings, and it's just it peaked in 2009. It went up slowly, but this year it jumped up again another 25%. And so you have thousands of civil society organizations in the United States, ranging across the board, actively engaged in this area.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Robert Brule from Drexel University, Coral Davenport from the New York Times, talking about the agreement in Paris over the weekend. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Friends Life Care, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY. Friends Life Care is a member organization designed for people who want to remain independent in their own home. Membership helps protect savings and prepare for unexpected changes in health. A plan is in place if care is ever needed. A nonprofit, Quaker-based organization since 1985, Friends Life Care offers educational seminars throughout the region. Details at friendslifecare.org.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Coming up next on Radio Times, what the proposed merger between corporate giants DuPont and Dow Chemical mean for employees, for shareholders, the Philadelphia region, and more. The new company is Dow DuPont. That's ahead at 11.
Your tax-deductible gift to WHYY means more art, more science, more local news, more global stories, more quality programming. Make your donation at whyy.org/support.
Do you know someone with mild to moderate Alzheimer's? A clinical trial is being conducted to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a study drug for the treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Qualified participants must be at least 50 years old and have a support person to attend study visits. Qualified participants receive study-related medical care, memory testing, and routine lab work. Details at 215-884-1700. 215-884-1700. The Clinical Trial Center supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Coral Davenport, who covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. She is in Paris. She has been reporting from the climate negotiations in Paris. Also with us, Robert Brule, professor of sociology and environmental science at Drexel University here in Philadelphia, just got back from Paris, and he currently serves as the co-director of the American Sociological Association's Task Force on Climate Change and Society. And again, what were you looking for? Were you even paying attention to what negotiators were wrestling with and negotiating on in Paris? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Coral, let me go back to you. Is there anything in this agreement about the world getting off of fossil fuels?
That is the intended purpose of the agreement. ultimately the agreement, the specific language in the agreement calls for greenhouse gas emissions to peak, global greenhouse gas emissions to peak as soon as possible. That's obviously very vague phrasing.
Yeah.
And also calls for sort of zero greenhouse gas or carbon neutral greenhouse gas economy in the second half of the century. The broader purpose, the stated point of the agreement, and the measure really of its success or failure is this agreement going to send a signal to global financial markets to start moving money away from fossil fuels and towards lower or zero carbon forms of energy? Is this going, you know, by sending a signal that 186 governments are going to be pursuing policies permanently designed to lower greenhouse gas emissions, designed to lower market demand for the use of fossil fuels, is the market going to follow? In other words, is it going to be something that is done not for altruism, not out of a sense of moral sensibility, but is it going to become less and less profitable to invest in production of coal, oil, and gas, or burning of coal, oil, and gas, and more profitable to invest and develop in low or zero carbon forms of energy? That is fundamentally what this agreement is designed to do, is to line up all governments pointing in the same direction and send a signal to corporations and investors. This is where, you know, this is a strong, clear, consistent signal of where, you know, global policy is going, and is the money and the investment going to follow? You know, supporters of this deal say that's what it does. Certainly that is what it's designed to do. A lot of pieces are in place for that to happen. The big question, though, will be what will, you know, this is carried out in the future. How will world leaders future world leaders interpret this? Will they continue to bring forth really strong plans? Will they violate the law and not participate? The future world leaders of the major economies are going to have a lot to do with continuing the message of this deal, continuing to implement this deal.
And I guess the question, Robert, in this country is will that message resonate? Is there a market? Is there money to be made in the sort of non-fossil fuel energy?
Well, my understanding is that that renewables are continuing to become much, much more competitive. And so I guess it would depend on, you know, market by market. If you have a big sunk cost in the brand new coal-fired power plant you just built, you're not going to want to replace that right away. So whereas other places it's an old furnace, you want to replace it, you know, then it probably has a larger chance of being renewable. I think what was interesting, though, and I'd just like to bring up another point here,
sure,
is that what was interesting in the agreement was the whole upfront part about staying below 2 degrees and staying below 1.5, and the terminology used about what kind of world do we want to have. And it was carbon neutrality, not net zero emissions. And what that means is that net zero means we don't use fossil fuels anymore. We don't use that. We don't put any more emissions out. Whereas carbon neutrality means, okay, we might use fossil fuels to, say, fly jets, but then we have what's called carbon capture and sequestration efforts, where we take biofuels, burn them, and then take the carbon for that and sequester it underground, which gives us a net negative, and so then the two balance off. And the question I think that arises here is that, for me, the idea that we can stay below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees is really highly contingent on this whole idea of what's called BECCS, or bioenergy and carbon capture and sequestration. This involves an enormous infrastructure with a lot of technological development that has yet to be really proven economical at scale, as far as I can understand. And so there's a great big bet here on a technological solution that I'm not so sure really exists.
Do you think it exists, Carl? Or, I mean, obviously part of this agreement is to help the development of this kind of technology, I guess. But does it exist yet?
No, it doesn't. I mean, a lot of the success or failure of this agreement depends on future technology breakthroughs. What this agreement, part of the intent of this is to create a market in which investors are compelled or interested in investing heavily in the R&D for such technology breakthroughs because there's so much money to be made. The comparison that a lot of people draw with kind of the state of technology, the state of the kind of technology that's required, is to the IT market. You know, if you look at where IT technology was in the 1980s, and then you look at sort of what happened with the market for telecommunications and the breakthroughs that happened and the tremendous technology breakthroughs that happened in IT over between, say, 1985 and 2000, completely changed, you know, the technology picture. And so it's not an apples-to-apples comparison by any means, but the hope is that if you have a strong market demand, you know, if you have electric utilities saying, you know, we need breakthroughs in cheap, clean energy technology, we need, you know, storage, a massive scale electricity storage for solar and wind, so that we, you know, so those electricity sources won't be intermittent. We need it wide scale. We need it commercially deployed. You know, companies are going to look at that and say, all right, well, that's, you know, we're compelled to try to R&D such technology because every electric utility in the world is going, you know, needs to buy these in order to, because every government is, you know, has these commitments, you know, that their electric utilities have to meet. And so the hope is that it creates this strong enough demand, but it is, you know, it is, those technology breakthroughs are going to have to come. It sort of sets the stage and creates this demand. But absolutely, this is dependent on technology that doesn't yet exist. And it's making a bet that the market demand is going to lead to those breakthroughs.
Robert, I was in Germany a year or so ago, and you know, one driving around that country, you see windmills, you see windmill farms in many portions of Germany. Is there something that Germany has done or is doing that can be applied here in the United States?
Well, I think, first of all, if you look at Germany, they have a very strong Green Party. And so what you have is you have effective political demand that has been forcing the German government to take actions to address climate change. And so you can see that they've gone they're very, very serious about it in Germany, as opposed to the United States, where we sort of, more in the middle. And so for me, I'm a sociologist. So I look at the political constellation of forces that drive things. And under certain circumstances, you can have markets are going to respond to what the government says and a stable environment in that arena. Well, what changes the government behavior are political activity and political movements, either on the side of the climate, what I call the climate counter movement or climate denial efforts in the United States, or the climate movement in the United States. And so for me, it's more of an outcome of political factors, not necessarily technological factors. But to just add something onto the intended contributions in trying to stay below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, is I actually am quite confused about what that means. Is that when you look at the climate budgets, that we will run out of the climate space to stay below 1.5 degrees by about 2020 or 2021. We will have, if we go on our current trajectory, we will exceed the atmospheric concentration to stay below 1.5 degrees by the next time we start reviewing this treaty. And that 2 degrees is about 20 years out past that. The question is whether we can act fast enough to avoid what the original UN treaty called dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system set, which they define as 2 degrees, or maybe it's 1.5, but certainly somewhere in that range. And the question is, are these things going to happen quick enough and fast enough? And I think that that's a real concern of the climate scientists. And that's, they held a special, they actually sort of went rogue on Friday of the at COP21 and held their own press conference in a room where they weren't authorized and things like that. And they were all concerned about the time frame and saying that this is not enough, quick enough to avoid catastrophic or at least dangerous anthropogenic climate interference. And so they were very worried about that. And I don't see anything in the agreement that, you know, we're going to go back and review in 2020. But if that review doesn't really push up the timetable a lot more rigorously, we're going to be in for a lot of trouble down the line.
Carl, do you want to weigh in on that? Also, we have a comment. What sanctions are available for violations of the greenhouse gas accord? Do you want to weigh in? This is the agreement that global temperatures be kept below this either 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And I guess there's a question about whether this agreement does that soon enough. And of course, there are enforcement questions as well. And we've got the comment from Phyllis as well. Want to jump in on that?
Sure, I can take both of those. So, you know, the language in this agreement about temperature rise is aspirational. There's no legal binding element keeping anyone to 2 degrees. They're putting, you know, the authors put forth as a goal. The hope of this is to keep global temperatures under 2 degrees, atmospheric temperatures under 2 degrees, and even better, it would be even better if it were under 1.5 degrees. Well, that's great. If you look at what's actually the substance of what's been forth on the table, it gets you about halfway to the reductions you need just to meet that 2 degree target. So this is sort of, you know, putting a goal out there, but it's purely sort of saying this is what we're aiming for. We're about halfway there. And so, you know, this is, again, why this depends on future world leaders and breakthroughs in technology. But right now, this agreement only actually gets you about halfway there. It's a really great question about, are there legal sanctions? Yes, this is really important. So all the parties to the agreement, including the United States, are legally required to show up every 5 years with a stronger plan. Well, what if you don't do that? What if you are President Trump or President Rubio or President Cruz of the United States, and you have campaigned on a pledge, against climate policy, a pledge to undo President Obama's current climate policy, and yet you're legally bound to go to the UN and bring forth a plan that's even stronger? Well, what if you say, I don't agree with this and I'm not going to go? If you do that, there won't be any financial sanctions the way that economic sanctions there might be if you violate a trade agreement. No black helicopters are going to show up and punish you. But here is what the punishment is, and it's not insignificant. That provision is the United States is party to international law on this. If the United States or any other country chose to flout that international law and then, you know, decided to go back and need to enforce participation in another international law, the United States is party to a lot of international laws. If you are party to an international law and you blatantly flout it, and then you go, say, 6 months later or a year or two later, you go to the Security Council and you say, I want to use our legal participation, our status as legal party in some other kind of law that would have to do with military force, that would have to do with prosecution, that would require some sort of enforced or enforceable enforcement action by other countries. And the U.S. has flouted, or any other country has flouted their participation in this law, you really have delegitimized your legal status to do that. And that's not insignificant. That's pretty important.
About reputation. And mm-hmm. we're almost out of time here, so let me give Robert Brule just a chance to, while you catch your breath there, Carl, Robert, a chance to weigh in on that. I mean, I guess the question is whether this was the best agreement possible, whether it's too little, too late, or something in between. And we have about 15 seconds.
I would say it's probably the maximum political feasible, but it still falls short of what we really need to do to reduce our emissions so that we don't go well into dangerous anthropogenic climate change. I mean, it's a step in the right direction, But I don't think it's, you know, it's not the end of the struggle over climate change.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. We called you up this morning and you were available. Robert Brule, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He's a professor of sociology and environmental science at Drexel University. Carl Davenport, thank you very much as well.
Sure. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We have hour two waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.